Here's Andy Udman.
8 minutes after 10 o'clock on this Thursday morning. Folks, you will be shocked by what you're about to hear. We just did a segment. It sounded like a medical segment. It was more like a crime segment. A doctor here in London, tagged by his own peers for sexually abusing patients. You think that was shocking? Listen to what we are about to tell you. The number of people who die every day from the effects of prescription drugs. A jumbo jet full every day. 290 North Americans killed by prescription drugs every day. It's an absolute horror story. And it's not Pam Colleen who's saying it. It's not Andy Udman who's saying it. Read some of the articles like we've seen recently in the London Free Press. I'm looking at one by Dr. Gifford Jones. This is beyond shocking, folks. And how much of this do we know? That's why we are focusing this half hour on this particular issue. Good morning, Pam. How are you?
I'm great, Andy. How are you?
Let's get right to it, because this is shocking, Pam. And we have a horror story happening in Canada, all across the country, but specifically now from BC.
One is unfolding in British Columbia. It reads like a John Grisham novel. I have in my hands an article written by our guest this morning, Alan Castles. It's called The Best Place on Earth for Pharmaceutical Companies. And Alan has been unfolding this story in British Columbia. It's absolutely shocking what is happening. I mean, there's people getting fired. There's people dying. I mean, this is, you know, there's lawsuits being filed. There's something very mysterious going on in British Columbia with regards to their healthcare system right now.
Okay, let's explain first who Alan is, and then we'll bring him on.
Alan Castles is the author of two books. One is called Selling Sickness. The other is called Seeking Sickness. He's a drug policy researcher from the University of Victoria, and he joins us very early from British Columbia this morning. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Alan.
Have we
got
him?
Good to be back.
There we go. Alan, good morning. Sorry, we didn't have the right button pushed. How are you?
I'm here. Thank you. Yeah, good to be back.
Well, I love those titles. They are so intriguing, shall we say. Alan, you have a horror story out there in BC. Do share.
Well, you know, it might sound like a horror story, but really it's a confusing quagmire of a whole bunch of events that have occurred over the last year, which started with an investigation back in about June of last year, where the ministry announced that they were looking into irregularities in contracting and data access in the BC Ministry of Health. They started interrogating or doing this investigation, calling in and staff. Next thing you know, they have suspended a pile of employees, and in September they fired four employees, suspended three others, and everyone's asking what's going on here. Why is, and so the people that were dragged into this were people that were doing what I would call independent drug evaluation, examining how drugs are being used in the province and the dangers of those drugs. So safety evaluations, really, that seemed to be the focus of this effort. And it's really shut down the kind of drug safety evaluation apparatus that we've had in the ministry. And the ministry essentially won't give us any details on what's going on. But when you talk to the people who've been affected, it does sound like a sort of Kafka-esque approach. They haul people in, question them. Nobody tells them what they're being accused of. And then these firings and these... and, of course, the staff that have been fired are all... They've got lawsuits against the government.
So Alan, let's go right to the bottom line. Tell me that no one's life is in danger. No one's health is in danger.
Well, put it this way, when the government spends $1.3 billion a year on pharmaceuticals, you would think that there would be some level of safety monitoring of that drug supply. And I think it's now non-existent in BC. So are people's health in jeopardy? Well, you would think that you would want some level of safety monitoring. And
let me jump in with the questions that you were asking in your recent article. On May 23rd, 2012, last year, the anticoagulant drug Pradix became covered by BC PharmaCare. Since that date, how many BC citizens taking this drug have bled to death?
Right.
September 30th, 2011, BC PharmaCare started paying for drugs to help people stop smoking. Since that date, how many BC citizens taking Champix have committed suicide or had a cardiovascular event? And one more question you ask, and then I'll ask you for the answer. Since February 23rd of 2011, when a national drug safety study was launched, how many women in B.C. taking the acne drug Accutane delivered a baby with birth defects? You're asking the question, Alan. Can you suggest what the answers are?
Well, see, that's the problem. They can't answer those questions. Those are three of a handful of drugs that were under scrutiny and being evaluated in these safety evaluations. So we can't answer those questions because they've shut down and fired the people that were doing those evaluations. So, yeah, I mean, that first drug that you mentioned, dabigatran, it's a Pradex. It's a drug that's used for, it's an anticoagulant. It's typically used for to prevent atrial fibrillation. And it's being it's replacing warfarin, which, as you probably know, is a widely prescribed drug. And it's brought to the market as being newer, better. It's obviously a lot more costly.
Let me bring Pam into the issue. Pam, right to the bottom line. What's the issue here?
Well, you know, when in British Columbia, and Alan, you have this in your article, people are paying $274 per year. That's 4.4 million people. So that's a lot of money going into these drugs, Alan. And
yeah.
Don't you, and clearly you believe that they need more answers. They're not getting their money's worth when it comes to these drugs. And they're basically in the dark with regards to safety issues.
Absolutely. And so... Yeah, and these drugs are not these are not minor players. These are major, highly promoted drugs that are being and they're new. So new drugs always come onto the market with question marks, and unless you've got proper safety monitoring, you're not going to know the effect.
Alan, let me suggest the answer to the question that I'm going to ask. I hope it's no, Andy. Everything in Deb Matthews, Ontario, is just fine. It's not at all like it is out here in BC.
Well, you know, that's a tough question. I would say that there is some drug safety evaluation happening in Ontario. And, you know, people in my field who look at this always say there's too little and too late. So we're always playing catch up when it comes to trying to find safety problems with drugs. So that's the same across the country. One thing BC has that Ontario doesn't have is we have a data set that covers the entire population. So if the dangers of those drugs are found in people under 65, you wouldn't see that in the Ontario data.
Pam has a question.
Well, you've been in the news a lot lately, Alan. The Globe and Mail published your review of Ben Goldacre's book.
Yeah.
And in it, you're talking about how the data that is coming out is so heavily manipulated as well. So when the government is reviewing the pharmaceuticals data, they're really not getting the whole story.
Absolutely. And so that's why you need independent safety evaluation, independent study, because a lot of the data that that they're making decisions about, you know, can be skewed, could be missing. Ben Goldacre's book, talking about reading a book that turns like a page-turning crime thriller, you know, so much of what we take for granted in terms of pharmaceutical industry research, we think that when it's published, that is the truth. What we're not told is that maybe we've done a dozen studies on a drug. They published the two positive ones, and the 10 negative or neutral studies never see the light of day.
Alan, we talk about highway safety a lot, and we've just had a truck go veering off the 401 into the Nith River,
yes.
Down 60 feet. When it comes to car and safety issues, we have dramatic results like a tractor trailer going over the guardrail and into the river, computers as a floating down the river, and it's saturation use. But when that happens in someone's personal life because of the improper medication they're getting, we don't hear about it unless it's like a David Carmichael who strangled his own son in a hotel in South London and was on this show a couple of weeks ago, and we hear a horror story like that. But how many other horror stories are there of people who have negative side effects from prescription drugs, and we never know?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, a lot of what we do know comes through post-market safety reports. So if you have a bad experience with the drug, your doctor or pharmacist might make a report to Health Canada, and that's how that data is collected. But yeah, you're right. It's not a big splashy front cover story every time someone is hurt from a drug because it seems it's so routine. So, you know, we... you don't want to scare everyone off of taking prescription drugs. I mean, they're obviously drugs that are very valuable for the length and quality of people's lives. At the same time, you shouldn't be expecting that you're getting the full information about a drug when you take it, because it's a good chance the regulator doesn't have the full information, and the provincial government that's paying for it might not, and in the case of BC, might not actually be collecting drug safety data.
Alan, hold that thought. We have to take a commercial break, but I want to ask Pam. You know, there are some who are hearing this, and they're going, there you guys go again. You're demonizing Big Pharma. What's with you guys?
Well, how much money are we spending in this? I mean, people who go into medicine, people who go into nursing, et cetera, they go into this field to help people get well, Andy. They don't go into this field to fill the pockets of a CEO of the pharmaceutical company to the tune of millions of dollars every year. I mean, some of these CEOs are making $23 million, $30 million every single year. That's not why doctors and nurses go into the field of medicine.
I have a cousin who is right now working on a cottage up in the Muskokas for an executive with a drug company. He's been working on it, I think, for 4 years, and they just keep adding on because this guy has more money than you absolutely know what to do with. And, hey, if he's cured cancer, God bless him and send him a big check, paycheck. If we're all getting healthier because of this guy up on the Muskokas, God bless him. Build another cottage. We're getting sicker and fatter and more depressed than ever. We've got several health issues we're going to wrestle with. Back with Alan Castles in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. Here's a question for you. Would you rather be mugged by a thug in an alley, or would you rather be attacked by a criminal with a suit on? Who are the biggest criminals in the United States? Are they the drug runners on the streets of Detroit? Listen to this, folks. According to a recent analysis by the consumer group U.S. Public Citizen, the drug industry, and they're talking about prescription drugs now, has become the biggest defrauder of the U.S. federal government. In the last 20 years, four companies alone have been collectively fined $10.5 billion for criminal wrongdoing in the U.S., including withholding safety data, and promoting drugs for use beyond their license conditions. These people should be in prison.
Right. I always say GlaxoSmithKline has a rap sheet as long as my arm. I mean, how can we trust these people? There's just lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit going on out there, and people are not aware, and they don't look at this information as something that they should be using to be more discerning patients.
What would the pharmacists around London right now who are behind the counter with those lovely white
jackets? Oh, I talk to pharmacists and medical doctors and nurses. They're, you know, the ones I talk to, they're fed up. They want to get people well. These drugs shouldn't be the first line of defense. They should be looking at, as we talked about last week, you know, diet, lifestyle, et cetera.
Alan, time is so limited. What is it you would like to fix it? What would fix this problem, if that's an impossible question? What's the answer?
Yeah, that's a very tough question. I guess the main thing we need is that, you know, better regulation of how drugs get studied and used. Currently, you know, critics like myself are looking at the situation. It's almost like the fox is guarding the hen house when you think about who's overseeing things like advertising of drugs in Canada, the sale and promotion of drugs. It just seems that Health Canada is extremely passive. So certainly better regulation is absolutely mandatory. But while we're waiting for better regulation, the average person is going to say, well, I still trust my doctor, and I believe that, you know, the advice that they give me around drugs is sound.
Let me ask you about Health Canada. Yeah, you got a quote here. Alan Castles, a drug policy researcher at University of Victoria, says cholesterol-lowering drugs are not worth the risk, and history will regard CLDs, cholesterol-lowering drugs, as an unmitigated scandal in medicine. The author says, readers know I share this view, but here's the quote. Hell will freeze over before Health Canada raises an alarm and closes the door on these multi-billion dollar risky products. Whose side, Alan, is Health Canada on?
Well, clearly they're on the side of the manufacturers, and that it really is part of the problem. Most people would be surprised to know that Health Canada actually receives funding from the pharmaceutical industry to regulate drugs. So when you wonder who is Health Canada's client, they believe, I suppose, that their client is the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah, so it's actually a shameful state.
So essentially, they're passing on grease money to get their drugs approved.
Well, you might they wouldn't call it grease money. They would call it more. These are the fees that we pay for having our drugs approved in Canada. But when you're paying for a certain service, you expect that service to be fast and efficient. And so, quite frankly, we've seen many drugs come to the market too quickly, only to be withdrawn or to have safety warnings applied after the drug's been on the market.
Real quick question before you go. Your books are called Selling Sickness and Seeking Sickness.
Yes.
What are you trying to say?
People need to be skeptical about pharmaceutical information. They need to stand back, ask a lot of questions, look for alternatives, and realize that a lot of times somebody's trying to sell you a disease to sell you a drug.
Is Dr. Healy's initiative with risk.org, RxISK.org, his new database that he's creating, is that going to help matters at all?
Yeah, I hope so. He set up a database in order to collect stories or adverse event reports from people. I think that's really what we seriously need, is a better way to actually capture what's happening in the real world with experiences.
Your premier, Christy Clark, she may be cute, she may be savvy, she may be popular, but in BC, it sounds like she's about to get the boot. Is that a good thing in the context of the issues we're talking about?
It's a good question. The Liberals have been very cozy with the pharmaceutical industry. They've come out with some task force reports that have been really damning in terms of the public interest. So I don't think a new government could do worse.
Well, have you cheered me up?
That way, leave it there.
But in Ontario, Deb Matthews is looking after the storm. I'm sure things will be just fine. If there's one point you didn't get a chance to make that you want to make, Alan, what is it? We're almost out of time.
Yeah, again, all drugs have benefits, but they also come with adverse effects. And if you're taking a drug or being offered one, you have to look at that very closely. Talk to your doctor and your pharmacist about what are the potential downsides.
And your website, by the way, is just your name, right? AlanCassels.com?
That's right.
And Cassels is spelled Cassels, folks. Alan, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, Alan.
Okay.
Take care.
It's hard to hear, but wow. Alan Cassels, author of the books Selling Sickness and Seeking Sickness. Now, before we let Pam go out the door, there are several major issues in the news. In fact, there was one on the 10 o'clock news. Ed Wilmot had it. I want to share with you about eating processed meats, which I want to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a study on obesity,
right.
And there's a study on suntanning beds. I mean, the health issues out there are so overwhelming, mm-hmm. and on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. And they're still leaving people confused. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, we'll talk about mm-hmm. Those. And folks, our lines are open. Any of those, we're going to talk about them all in the next half hour. And we welcome your call, 643-1290, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Fewer calories equals weight loss. It's an equation that few experts would argue with. So the results of a new federal study just don't add up. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analyzed eating trends going back to the 70s, and they report that for almost a decade now, U.S. adults have been eating fewer calories. It's been a steady decrease over the period, and it comes despite a steady increase in the nation's obesity rate. Today, more than a third of adult Americans are obese. Jim Genovese, CBS News.
10:37 now. I'm keeping Pam extra long today because we have several, and I mean several stories involving health that I just have to get Pam's input on. Ontario's health minister, of course, is Deb Matthews. After totally bungling a number of portfolios, including where do we start with Deb Matthews and the entire Liberal government? But Deb now has a promotion, and she's now the deputy premier. I have to applaud some of the initiatives that she's been into lately, including a new one today. And there's several issues we're going to tackle here. But I want to get your reading, folks, on the suntan, the sunbed industry. It is a major industry. And, of course, we have these parlors all over London. I was a little shocked this morning, I got to tell you, by Steve Buchanan's comments. And I want to share them with you, if we could, Ryan, audio clip number 4. I mean, this is an industry which just vilified us in the media whenever we ran a report on suntanning parlors. I can remember having not physical fights, but virtually physical fights with people down the hall at this radio station when we ran reports about the suntanning parlor and suggesting there was a link to cancer. They'd come up the hall and they'd be screaming. I remember one of them saying, "Where do you get your news anyway?" Well, actually, it was the lead story last night on ABC And it's these are major medical reports being reported around the world. Well, this link between suntan beds and cancer, you guys are just making that up. Well, it's kind of gratifying after all these years to see that we're finally getting some action. Health Minister Deb Matthews says she will introduce legislation this afternoon, and we're talking Thursday, the 7th day of March. Ontario will be the latest province, we're not the first, to table legislation banning minors, got to start somewhere, from using tanning beds. She will introduce a bill today that would ban the sale of tanning services to people under the age of 18. And all I can say is about bloomin' time. Absolutely. But I was absolutely shocked, somewhat amused, by the reaction this morning from a spokesman for the suntanning business who has fought us so hard on this issue for so many years. When he talked to Steve Garrison, here was his reaction.
I think this is the most fantastic thing that's happened in the tanning business since its inception about 30, 31 years ago. And I really commend the Liberals for getting this into the House as a government bill so that it has the opportunity to be vetted by all and a proper piece of legislation come forward to protect all Ontarians.
Okay, let me give you a few more details. The bill would also require operators to request ID from anyone who appears to be under 25 and set fines for those who break the rules. Advertising and marketing of tanning services aimed at those under 18 would also be prohibited. The minority Liberals will need support from at least one of the opposition parties to pass the bill, which will likely come from the NDP. The New Democrats have been lobbying for a ban for years, saying it will protect many young people from skin cancer. So it's a gratifying day for me. And I just, before we move on to obesity and a number of other issues, Pam, what are your thoughts on the suntanning business?
No, I do see the need for some controls. I sit on the fence on one issue and one issue only. It has nothing to do with the aesthetic value of these facilities. What I say is, if I have somebody I'm working with who has deep depression, for example, and it's worsened in January, and they tell me they go into a tanning bed and it helps to lift their mood, I can't argue with that benefit. That's the only thing I see, that there's a possibility where there could be some benefit to these beds. But for aesthetic reasons, for the chronic use of it, absolutely, there should be warnings. People should apply the precautionary principle in their own lives. If there's any doubt, leave it out. But certainly, if people are using it for more medicinal reasons to help them elevate their moods, I cannot argue with that. I'd rather them use light to lift their mood than to take something like Prozac.
Okay. Now let's move to obesity studies. We have one in Canada. We have one in the U.S. You want to talk about the one from Deb Matthews? Let's look at the fat study, if we could, south of the border.
Fewer calories equals weight loss. It's an equation that few experts would argue with. So the results of a new federal study just don't add up. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analyzed eating trends going back to the 70s, and they report that for almost a decade now, U.S. adults have been eating fewer calories. It's been a steady decrease over the period, and it comes despite a steady increase in the nation's obesity rate. Today, more than a third of adult Americans are obese. Jim Genevieve, CBS News.
There
they
go.
Laughing.
Yeah, well, because they finally are starting to catch on. They're connecting the dots. This new report here in Ontario is saying count calories and you're going to lose weight. And it's never worked. It hasn't worked in decades. There's a big difference between good calories and bad calories. If you count the calories in something like butter, there's going to be a lot of calories in there. But guess what? Butter is going to stabilize your hormones so that you don't gain weight. Fat does not make us fat. And it just so happens that something like butter is high in calories, but it's very good for you. So this idea of calories in, calories out is a myth. It has been since the inception of this notion. And clearly, since we've been doing these things, we're fatter, sicker, more depressed than ever before. It's not working for us. And this new report that came out, this Ontario report on obesity, it's perpetuating this myth. So they're saying, you know, kids are obese today because they're not getting enough exercise. Well, that's a red herring. Research has been done out of the United Kingdom, done by a professor, Terry Wilkin, and he shows that children today are no less active than they were 30 years ago. And he challenged the health department in England and said, you know, that inactivity is not the leading cause of obesity. We have to start looking at other options. And of course, what he's saying and what other experts are saying is that it's the food that's causing the obesity epidemic. Because what's really happening with inactivity is, and he proved this in his research, is that the food that the children are eating today, that's this junk food diet that they're on, this high carbohydrate, low fat diet, that is causing kids to be lethargic. And that is what is leading to inactivity. It's not inactivity that's leading to obesity. The precursor is the food system in and of itself. And of course, in this Health Canada report, they're continuously endorsing the high carbohydrate, low fat diet, which is what has made us sick since a post-World War II era. So they're talking about things like, you know, the Heart and Stroke Foundation. They're talking about things like Breakfast for Learning. All of these organizations are endorsing a high carbohydrate, low fat diet, which is what has made us sick to this day. What they need to realize is this high carbohydrate, low fat diet is diametrically opposed to our ancestral diet. It's not working for us. And Andy, you know the definition of insanity. The definition of insanity is to keep doing what we're doing and expecting different results. So where is it in this report that is saying that we should increase our consumption of animal fat, start honoring nutrient-dense foods, and basically return to traditional eating habits? Because when we know before World War II, when we ate a high-fat, low-carb diet, when we got about 70% of our calories from animal fat, we were actually pretty healthy back then, and we did not have an obesity epidemic. This is not rocket science, Andy, but unfortunately, because of so much corruption and collusion and misinformation out there, 90% of the population is still following a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet. The government is still putting out this misinformation, and we have to get it right if we are truly going to solve this obesity crisis.
Boil that down to 30 seconds. Why are we fatter in North America than we've ever been?
It's because of dangerous nutritional misinformation that we're getting from our universities, from our media, and from our government. Dangerous misinformation.
What are we eating we shouldn't be? What should we be eating?
We should be eating 3 square meals a day the way we used to eat, say, for example, prior to World War II. Prior to World War II, we didn't have fat phobia, we didn't have cholesterol phobia, egg phobia, red meat phobia, liver phobia, chicken skin phobia. We didn't have any of those food phobias before World War II, Andy. And guess what? We were pretty healthy back then.
Let me just throw that out to our audience. Do you believe what Pam is saying? And if you don't, we welcome your call, 643-1290. Fat does not make you fat. That's the one I keep coming back to because it's so simple.
And it's carbohydrates that drive insulin and insulin that drives fat. This is in endocrinology. This is common sense, right?
Not to most people, it's not.
Yeah, well, that's because the information isn't getting to the people. And in this obesity report, actually, when I scanned it, I found 2 sentences that made any sense at all. It said, as a culture, many of us have fallen out of the pattern of family meals where we know the ingredients in what we eat and have more control over portion size. Family meals help establish healthy eating behaviors and decrease the risk of unhealthy weight gain. Of course, what they're talking about here is coming from an era pre-World War II when we sat down and ate 3 square meals a day and didn't have any of these irrational food phobias.
Okay, just before we go to the phones, you don't have to get involved in this, okay? Because I sometimes go to places you don't want to go. But I am not paid to be nice. I am paid to tell it like I see it. We have a new premier who's a runner. She looks extremely fit. Chris Bentley from London is a runner. He looks extremely fit. So who do we put in the health portfolio? Someone who, when you see her on TV, well, it's obvious. Is it too much to ask for a health minister who looks healthy? And Deb Matthews does not look healthy. Would you agree?
No, she doesn't look healthy. No, she doesn't look healthy.
And thank you.
And look at Arlene King as well. She does not look healthy. We need spokespeople who are actually genuinely healthy, not dealing with things like obesity, not dealing with things like depression, insomnia, hormonal problems. We need to know that they are genuinely healthy.
And so when we see Deb Matthews the other day announcing mm-hmm. this crackdown on advertising for junk food for kids mm-hmm. and talking about the obesity problem, I'm thinking it might have been more effective if we'd had Kathleen Wynne make the announcement.
Well, what I heard on CTV the other day when that report came out was a reporter, and she said this with a straight face. She said, the reason why the government decided not to impose a fat tax, Andy, and this reporter said it with a straight face, they're not putting the fat tax out there is because they want people who can't afford things like Snickers bars to be able to afford them. I'm not joking. I'm not joking.
Unbelievable. Let's go to the phones. Tim, Ryan, and Dave. Let's start with Tim. Tim, go ahead.
Morning to both of you. I was just calling in to comment on what Pam said about insulin or you know, blood glucose control. Any meal or healthy eating plan that I've read, and I've read a lot about it, it all concerns that. If they're not talking about that with what their recommendations are, then it's not going to be of any assistance to a person to get healthier. Because as soon as that insulin spikes, as Pam said, it just changes everything in your body and your endocrine system. And you you know, you're lost already. So I was interested, Pam, you said three square meals a day. Are you not a fan of the five smaller meals?
Well, when I'm working with people who are very, very sick, they do need to eat more consistently through the day. It's just before World War II, when we were actually healthier, we were able to sustain our blood sugar levels through this commonsensical, you know, three-square meal paradigm. And, of course, since we have thrown off our metabolism so much, yes, indeed, when people are very sick, they do sometimes need to eat snacks. But when people have really good ability to control blood sugar, they're fine with three-square meals a day. It's just they have to get to that point where they stabilize.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, okay. Are you a proponent then of sort of the ratio of carbohydrate, protein, and fruits and vegetables, that approach?
Well, the ratios really should be about 70% fat, 20% protein, 10% carbs. And one of my favorite books that endorses this notion, because I think it makes it very simple for people to understand, is a book called Life Without Bread, and it's written by Dr. Wolfgang Lutz. And he was a medical doctor who for 40 years in his practice got his patients to follow that formula, and he saw nothing but good things happen.
And one other quick question, just I think one of the hard parts when I read a lot of these books is then they'll give you a meal plan, right? And you look into it, and half of the things in there, most people don't like kale, lentils. Some people don't like salmon. And it's very difficult for people to adjust these menus or meal plans to find things that they like, to have enough variety to stay with them.
Well, if people want to go to my website, just go to pamkaleen.com, and I have a second page. The second page, I have all sorts of menu and meal idea links there to give people some ideas. But really, healthy eating fundamentally is not difficult to do. You know, to teach people to eat three square meals a day is not difficult. What becomes difficult is the misinformation, is the confusing and conflicting information that people are getting. If you imagine these black and white films that we would have seen, you know, in 1940s, 1950s, and people sat down and ate a healthy, wholesome breakfast, healthy, wholesome lunch and dinner, homemade meals, and they had a bacon and egg breakfast, they had a meat and potato style lunch and dinner. They were healthy back then.
Tim, we have to leave it there. I want to get Ryan and Dave on. Ryan, go ahead.
Good morning. I was just wondering about the preservatives in the lard that was introduced, I think it was in 1910, which had a lot to do with cardiovascular problems that emerged around the World War II era. Does that have anything also to do with what you're talking about as far as people getting fatter and healthier, and also because the generation of the GMO food is just now the first generation, really?
Right. We'll let you go until
I... Does that have anything to do with the poor quality of our food and our fatness?
It's really very, you know, extensive in terms of the adulteration of our food supply. But what I tell people is, let's focus on the solution. You want to avoid GMOs, you want to avoid all these additives in our food supply, then go to a local farmer, buy your food straight from the farm, make your homemade meals, and you can avoid a lot of these issues. But indeed, since about 1909, since the hydrogenation process was invented, and then you fast forward to the World War II era when heart disease was taking a dramatic increase, what had happened in that era is we started eating more edible oils, and we started eating more sugar in our diet. And, of course, these are the things that can lead to inflammation and cause disease. The problem was never to do with animal fat or cholesterol.
Okay, Ryan, appreciate it. Let's go to Dave. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. One of the issues that my mom, she was a dietitian and always talked about, and I think the other little elephant in the room is certainly it's just portion control. You see the sheer size of what people are eating, whether it is for, you know, breakfast, lunch, or dinner, and also, too, for the young kids. It's also the empty calories, the snacking between meals. And the idea that you always have to be consuming food to the point of gross satiation, I never want to eat to the fact that I feel too stuffed. Not my grandparents' era where they would just feed you till your belly was bursting. And I think this has also been a major problem. No question, the processed food. But, you know, families are so busy, and the parents at home are the ones that really have to take the lead with the children, because no matter how much the government may want to step in and do these type of things, it is about the portion control. But look at like a super big gulp. Who needs 34 or 36 ounces of soda or a latte from Tim Hortons with 32 grams of fat and 500 calories? This type of consumption is very much what I think is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And I think the genie's out of the bottle. It's never going to go away, because the proliferation of fast food on virtually every corner. You can think, Andy, when you and I were very young, maybe I don't know your age, Pam, but in the 1960s and the early 70s, there was very few proportionally fast food places. We're now kids, for everything for a dollar, you can get something that just creates nothing but empty calories and you're just stacking it on to what you will then have for your breakfast,
and
lunch,
and dinner.
And
you mentioned a key word, satiation, satiety, S-A-T. Look at the first three letters of that word. What satisfies our appetite is animal fat, and everybody's been scared off of animal fat. So when people aren't getting enough animal fat in their diet, they're going to keep eating and eating and eating.
Dave, I appreciate the call. I want Ryan to play a processed meat. That was the one story we haven't gotten to yet, and it just came in this morning. It was from Ed's 10 o'clock news, because there's two words there, and one you like and one you don't like. Processed, you absolutely don't like, but meat you do. So what do you do? Here's the report.
In a large European study, men and women who consumed processed meats increased their risk of early death, especially from heart disease and cancer. The researchers from Switzerland estimate in the journal BMC Medicine that 3% of early deaths could be prevented if people ate less than an ounce of processed meat daily.
Isn't that politically correct? 1 ounce daily, Andy. So they don't want to step on the toes of the industry. You'd have to watch and listen to their words very carefully, right? As you said, I don't like the word processed. If people are going to eat sandwich meats, make a roast on a Sunday night, slice it up. You can have a turkey sandwich. You can have a roast beef sandwich. You can have control over your quote-unquote deli slices that way. And there's less interference from man in terms of making your sandwiches that way. But in terms of processed meats in general, a study like this is kind of flawed in the first place, because they're not necessarily looking at other foods that these people might be eating. If they're eating a lot of processed foods, how much sugar are they eating at the same time?
I'm suspicious of all studies. Yeah, I just look in local restaurants and I go, are we healthier or are we not?
Right. There's just so much room for error when you look at these kinds of food studies. But I do agree exactly with the idea that, you know, we really do need to be judicious in terms of how much processed meat we're eating. But instead of, again, focusing on what not to do, let's focus on what to do. And that is to eat real meat.
I have a confession right at the end here. I love bacon. I love bacon. I have it at 3 o'clock in the morning, two slices. And now when I get home, I'm not going to tell anybody else this. Between you and I have another slice of bacon with a little slice of cheese. That's my treat of the day. No chocolate or booze or anything else. Bacon and cheese. Is that okay, Pam?
Absolutely. Bon appetit.
Thank you. Very
healthy.
Thank you. You got anything coming up that we need to know about?
In April, I have two classes going on with regards to the gut and brain connection. So if you go to pamcolleen.com and you go to upcoming events, I'm teaching these two classes at the Central Library. And then I'm also teaching in Toronto in early April, April 5th and 6th. I'm teaching a couple of classes at the Total Health Show.
Awesome. Awesome. Pam Killeen, and your website is?
It's just my name, pamkilleen.com, pamkilleen.com.
11 o'clock news coming up, Stompin' Tom. He's a national hero, national treasure. We've lost him, but we've got his music. Let's share some memories about the guy with a sheet of plywood. Have you ever heard of a singer bringing along a sheet of plywood? Wow, have we shared memories in the newsroom this morning, and I'd love to hear yours about this guy from PEI. Now, what a personal story, begging on the streets at the age of 4. Wow. And he's the guy who made us laugh? What a lesson. We'll be back with memories of Stompin' Tom Connors in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.